This is episode 312 of That Shakespeare Life. Just like the work of William Shakespeare, That Shakespeare Life is made possible by our patrons. Listeners just like you can support the show right now at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife and access special insider extras. Join us today and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Chris Lautaris, the author of Shakespeare's book about the Shakespeare First Folio. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
Alarum is literally a call to arms in the form of a sound produced often off stage before or during a battle, and it's often with drums, but it can also be with trumpets.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
In Shakespeare's lifetime, sound was often relied upon by playwrights to let an audience know a battle was taking place, an army was taking action, or a particular military event was about to occur. Some of these military sound cues are found in the stage directions of Shakespeare's plays, when we see him indicate musicians should sound specific pieces. For example, the musicians are directed to, quote, sound a parley in Coriolanus Act 1, and to play, quote, alarum to battle in Henry IV Part 1. Here today to share with us the 16th century military history behind these sounds is our guest, Christian Dale. Christian Dale is Associate Professor in Comparative Literature at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. His publications focus on ancient Greek and early modern literature. He has published a monograph in Danish on Greek tragedy, co-authored books on early modern literary history, republicanism, and his publications also include several articles on early modern drama in England and France. Currently, Christian is participating in a collective and comparative research project called Histories about the multiple hybrids of historiography, poetics, and aesthetics in European theater between 1550 and 1650. As part of this project, Christian has recently published a study of the battle scenes and their popularity in the age of Shakespeare in the literary journal Orbis Literarum. It's this study that Christian joins us to talk about today. Hello, Christian. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I've been looking forward to talk to you.
We are excited about this topic as well. It's going to answer a lot of questions we've had for a while about Shakespeare's stage directions, I think. Speaking of which, in Shakespeare's play, Richard III, the climactic scene where Richard is killed, sorry about the spoilers, gets described in the stage directions as, quote, alarum, enter Richard and Richmond, they fight, Richard is slain, retreat and flourish, enter Richmond, Derby bearing the crown with divers other lords, end quote. Christian, these stage directions seem really sparse considering the magnitude of the historic battle scene that is meant to be represented here. How important are sounds, alarum and flourish, that are mentioned here for conveying the scene as a whole?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct that these stage directions are very sparse and puzzling in many ways. I mean, Richard III is one of Shakespeare's most speaking characters. He actually is the most speaking character, and then he more or less dies in silence. We have these stage directions telling about how they fight without uttering a word, but then we have these alarums and later the retreat and flourish. So these are musical signals well known from battle plays and from military battlefields and exercises and so on. In some ways, it's a bit surprising because Shakespeare has been building up for this, for the big battle at Bosworth Hill for, well, all of the fifth act. We've heard Richard speak a lot. He's a brilliant orator. He's given a very effective oration just before the battle. And when he starts to lose in the fight, he utters these famous last words, a horse, a kingdom for a horse. And then he retreats from the stage and comes back in this seventh scene where he doesn't utter a word and is finally killed. However, as you say, these stage directions convey a lot of information about what is going on the stage. And these musical signals are very typical of early modern drama and convey very special meanings, which are so conventional that audiences would recognize what is going on.
So alarum is not just a theater sound. This is a standard military sound. Would it be similar to like reveille or taps when you're saying they were conventional? I'm assuming that means they were immediately recognizable.
Yeah. Alarum is literally a call to arms in the form of a sound produced often off stage before or during a battle. And it's often with drums, but it can also be with trumpets. Earlier in the play, Richard calls for a flourish, trumpets, strike, alarum, drums. So here we hear that the alarum is with drums, but it can also be with a trumpet. But these are very recognizable sounds, I believe. The alarum is also the most widespread musical signal in the battle plays. I think it could be varied quite a lot, but it's nonetheless short and recognizable.
Well, what about the flourish? You mentioned there was an alarum and then a flourish. Was this a separate kind of sound? And we can tell from what little Shakespeare does give us that this noise is intended to be played by musicians. But what kind of sound was it? Do we know what instruments would have played a flourish?
Yes, a flourish is another very frequently used musical signal. And I think there are some 500 plus flourishes in the corpus of early modern drama. So also very frequent. These were usually played by cornets and trumpets are the musical instruments that are used for flourishes. But flourishes are not exclusive of battle signals. So they are used as a fanfare or a short musical phrase to signal and celebrate the entrance of important persons like kings or queens or generals, often at important public moments like the celebration of victory, as in this play. You also have in Hamlet, when the king Claudius and Queen Gertrude and the council make their first official entrance, it is signaled with a flourish. And you find it in many other plays, as I mentioned before.
Now, in Coriolanus, the stage directions indicate the musicians are supposed to play yet another sound. They call it sounding a parley before the senators enter the scene. So explain for us, what is a parley and how is it always played? Or I guess, is it always played to announce the entrance of an important figure, like a flourish, but different?
Yes, the parley is a much more specific signal conveying an important message in armed conflict. We talked before about these alarums, which are alarms, and you find them many places, and the function is not so specific. But with the parley, it's much more specific. A parley denotes that either a conference between enemies is taking place, or the sound of a parley signals a request for a truce from either side in order to have a conference with the enemy. It's a signal to end the fighting and start talking.
So anyone who is a fan of the Pirates of the Caribbean and immediately associate parley with that movie, you can feel confident that the parley means the same thing, but there is a musical sound associated with this concept of requesting a conversation with someone you're fighting with. We're going to pause the fighting and now we're going to talk.
Yes, precisely. I'm not sure exactly how it sounded, but it definitely has this very specific meaning. So, for instance, in the first folio edition of Shakespeare's Richard II, you have this when the king is under siege from Henry Bolingbroke, you have a stage direction saying, parley without and answer within. So Bolingbroke's army sounds a parley and the king responds, and then the king steps up on the wall and starts talking with his enemy and they come to an agreement. And you find something similar but more complicated in Coriolanus, and that's why I started with Richard II. But in Coriolanus, the title hero, Caius Martius, as he is called in this early part of the play, leads a Roman army which lays siege to a Volscian city called Coriolis. They sound a parley because they want to confer with the besieged army. And then the senators appear on the wall, not the Roman senators, but the Volscian senators, and they start talking with each other. And in this scene, both parties are under enormous pressure. The Volscians, because the Romans are laying siege on them, but also the Romans, because they fear that a Volscian expedition army is approaching on them, so they might risk getting under attack from both sides. And while the senators and Caius Martius are talking to each other, the Volscians suddenly hear alarums and drums from afar off, as the stage direction says. So this gives an indication that the Romans are under pressure, and that provokes Caius Martius to make his heroic assault on the city and get into the city. And it's successful, but also a very dangerous move for him. So here we see how Shakespeare makes use of offstage sounds in a way to represent a quite complicated military situation with an army approaching, a besieging army, and then the defenders and things happening between them. And this is, I think, indicative of how the mature Shakespeare often creates battle scenes where not only musical instruments, but also the players interact in complicated ways, which are quite breathtaking and communicate difficult or complex historical military situations, which are way beyond what most other dramatists of the age were able to do.
You've given several examples here of plays that use these sounds to amplify the battle scene for the purpose of performing these things on stage. But were these sounds, like alarum, flourish, and parley, actual military pieces of music? For example, if we were at the actual Battle of Bosworth, would any of these musical sounds have been played on the battlefield?
I'm not sure about this early age, I mean, late 15th century, which battle music instruments were in use at that time. But in the 16th century, you had a lot of new handbooks and manuals on the art of war, and they always mention musical signals and how to use military music correctly. You know, the drummers and pipers were a kind of communications officers in early modern armies who could communicate between officers and the soldiers, and also between different units. And I see no reason why theaters should be very different from contemporary warfare in the days of Shakespeare. So in that way, I think these musical signals are very realistic in many ways. I think we have a tendency in our own age to focus very much on visual representation when we think of early modern warfare or medieval warfare. We have become used to watching blockbuster movies like Braveheart and Shakespeare films, even, which have these fantastic panoramas of clashing armies and so on. But if you look at Shakespeare's plays and the playbooks, it's very obvious that the acoustic part of it was very important for playwrights and also for audiences, because the playwrights are so specific with the information they give in the stage directions, which they, of course, give not only to the players, but also to the readers of the playbooks.
Yeah. These sounds of battle were so intimately connected with the minds of Elizabethans that Christian writes in his research about one moment in 1595 when a local theater company's battle scene performance was significant enough to defend the actual town from invasion. Christian, tell us this story.
Yeah, it's a story we have from Thomas Heywood's Apology of Actors, a book which came out in 1612. Thomas Heywood was a colleague, dramatist of Shakespeare, and he tells us an anecdote from the time of the Spanish Armada about how a theater performance prevented the invasion of a small Spanish army. I can give you the whole quotation here from Heywood, because it's quite funny. He says, a strange an accident happened to a company some 12 years ago, or not so much, who, playing in the night at a place called Perrin in Cornwall, certain Spaniards were landed the same night, unsuspected and undiscovered, with intent to take the town, spoil and burn it, when suddenly, even upon their entrance, the players, ignorant as the townsmen of any such attempt, presenting a battle on the stage with their drum and trumpets, stroke up a loud alarm, which the enemy, hearing and fearing they were discovered, amazedly retired, made some few idle shots in a bravado, and then in a hurly-burly fled disorderly to their boats. Of course, we do not know if this happened precisely as Heywood tells us. It probably didn't, but actually the landing of this flotilla did take place in 1595.
So the theater was realistic enough that that's just the sound of it made this invading army hightail it back to their ships.
Yes, I think I'm not sure there was a theater performance of the time, but the anecdote certainly tells us that Heywood finds the acoustic make-believe very convincing, because otherwise the story would be incredible. And I think if these things happen in open daylight, a group of players would not be able to scare away an invading army. But Heywood's anecdote is also interesting, because Heywood is the only other playwright who comes close to Shakespeare in sheer numbers of alarums and flourishes and retreats. So Heywood wrote a lot of plays with a lot of noise and musical instruments and fight scenes and so on. Heywood, many of his plays were written a bit later than Shakespeare, but he wrote for a theater called The Red Bull, which was the last of the old style open air theaters. And I think the theater buildings are important for understanding the use of these musical signals, because if you look beyond the time of Shakespeare, you see that battle scenes disappear from the playbooks, and also the use of these noisy musical instruments like drums and trumpets. Most literary historians assume that the disappearance of fight scenes is because England went from a conflictual time during the reign of Elizabeth to a more peace-seeking era under James I. So some people assume that the disappearance of fight scenes and noise and so on has to do with political change. But if you look at when these things begin to disappear, it's at the time of Shakespeare's death. It's in the 1610s. And that has to do with the fact that now playwrights are starting to write for another kind of theaters, which are hall theaters, indoor theaters, which have very different acoustic conditions. And here, gunshots and flourishes and drums and so on and noisy battle scenes simply become too noisy. They become an aesthetic problem. So you see that they begin to disappear. But the last playwright who continues to write in the old vein is Thomas Heywood, who writes for a theater which continues to stage new plays in an open-air arena theater. So I think that's quite interesting, that you have to think of not only of the musical signals, but also of the performance conditions of the age. So everyone has been in a theater and heard gunshots and so on. And sometimes it's so noisy that children start crying and so on. So I see why these things can become a problem for modern directors. And here you have to be aware that the conditions in the theaters of Shakespeare's age were simply different.
One of the things we talk a lot about on our show is how Shakespeare's plays are not literature. They're scripts. And my listeners will recognize my personal soapbox here when I say that the best way to understand and enjoy Shakespeare's plays is to see them performed on stage instead of only reading the script like a book. And one of the reasons that I believe that is demonstrated through the study of sounds like alarum and parley, because the history behind battle scene performance and the purpose of these sounds in stage drama highlights the gap between reading a script and seeing a play performed. Christian, what can you tell us about how pure literary criticism of the battle scenes we're discussing today might miss some important information by relying only on the text instead of the history of performance?
Yes, you're right that literary critics prefer the poetic aspect of drama. They talk of theater as dramatic poetry and so on. So they tend to focus very much on the speech part and less on the stage action. And if you read Shakespeare's plays or other playwrights, if you're not an experienced reader, you tend to overlook these small pieces of information given in the stage directions. Also because they're so conventional, there are so many alarums and so many flourishes, but you have to focus on the meaning they convey. But if you go back to even literary criticism at the time of Shakespeare, you also see how critics scorn the popularity of battle scenes. So famously, Sir Philip Sidney, in his Defense of Poesy, makes fun of English theater where everything can take place on stage. So he says, two armies fly in, represented with four swords and bucklers, and what hard heart would not receive it for the pitched field? And later, Ben Jonson also mocks the popularity of Shakespeare's plays on the War of the Roses, and he makes fun of how the players with three rusty swords and help from some few foot and half foot words fight over York and Lancaster's long jars. So this gives us an idea that these fight scenes were often very clumsy. They might work in duel scenes, but when you have large battle scenes, it's unconvincing. This criticism, you find it over and over again in the history of criticism. But the most interesting comment on it is found in an essay by the romantic German critic Friedrich Schlegel, who wrote around 1800 at a time when Shakespearean plays had become very popular in Germany. And he reflects on the problem of stage fights. And he says, it is certainly laughable enough that a handful of awkward warriors in mock armor by means of two or three swords, with which we clearly see they take especial care not to do the slightest injury to one another, should decide the fate of mighty kingdoms. So here he says that, well, the make-believe doesn't work with these fight scenes. But then he continues and says and reflects on what happens if the make-believe actually works, because that's also a problem to Schlegel. He says, quote, but the opposite extreme is still much worse. If we in reality succeed in exhibiting the tumult of a great battle, the storming of a fort and the like, in a manner calculated in any way to deceive the eye, the power of these sensible impressions is so great that they render the spectator incapable of bestowing that attention with which a poetical work of art demands, and thus the essential is sacrificed to the accessory, unquote. And this is a criticism, I believe, which you can also find today, that even the most spectacular and convincing film adaptation of Shakespeare removes our focus from the speech parts, from the poetic parts, to the mere action parts. And I think this is a fair criticism. It's a fair problem. But then if you look at what Shakespeare actually does in his best plays, like the first part of Henry IV, you have this great representation of the Battle of Shrewsbury, where you have a lot of stage action, but also many scenes in which the key players interact with each other, have great speech parts. You have comedy, you have tragedy, you have historical information intermingling in ways which are both very entertaining, but also very critical and thoughtful.
Now, I know we would love to explore more about military sounds and how they're used on stage for Shakespeare's lifetime. What are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use to learn more?
Yeah, the study of Shakespeare's military world, so to speak, began with a book called Shakespeare's Military World, which was written in, it came out in 1956, and it's written by an author called Paul A. Jorgensen, he's the first who writes about how strongly interconnected early modern theater or Shakespearean theater is with warfare, with handbooks on warfare, and also the military record of many players and dramatists and so on. So he covers many aspects, not only of how the plays were produced, but also about the historical background, why representations of warfare became so important in late Elizabethan drama. I mean, if you look at the theater history, you find nothing which compares with early modern English theater in the classical tradition. You can have plays about war, but you don't represent war on stage. You don't have stage fights and so on. So this inventiveness is an Elizabethan invention. I can recommend Charles Edelman has written a dictionary of Shakespeare's military language. There's also a book by Andrew Dessen about stage directions, where you can get information about all these words you find in the stage directions, what they precisely mean. Charles Edelman also wrote a book about sword fights in Shakespeare, and it's a very entertaining book, so I can really recommend it.
These are excellent resources, and we will link to these books in the show notes for today's episode, along with more information on Christian's work into the history of Alorum, Flourish, and Parley. So if you'd like to explore these things further, be sure to stay tuned for the show notes URL for where you can find those. Now, Christian, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
Yeah, that's a difficult question, Cassidy. This last week, I've been having exams with my students in literary history from Homer to Shakespeare. So I wanted to say that my favorite book would be Homer's The Iliad. However, I fear that now I've talked so much about war plays, and then putting The Iliad on top of it would become too militaristic. So instead, I think I would choose Ovid's Metamorphoses, which is also, as you surely know, the classic author, which was most important for Shakespeare. And this is such a rich work, and you can return to it over and over again and read not just from the first song to the final song, but across the Metamorphoses. That would be very fun to read along with Shakespeare.
I think those would be excellent choices for sure. What's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Yeah, actually, I'm writing on a book about the early modern rediscovery of the ancient Greek romance novel. So most people don't know that in late antiquity or in the imperial age, the Greeks wrote a number of small romance novels, which were rediscovered in the 16th century, and they became very popular, and echoes of them are even found in Shakespeare's work, like in particular A Winter's Tale. It was channeled through Robert Greene's Pandosto, but you also find echoes in Romeo and Juliet and so on, and I'm quite curious about that.
That sounds fascinating. I can't wait to see what you've uncovered with that research. Christian Dale, thank you so much for being here today and taking us through the history of words like alarum and parley and helping us understand what these sounds would have been like on Shakespeare's stage. This has been an interesting conversation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All of the books and resources you heard us talk about in today's conversation are linked for you in the show notes for today's episode. You can find more information on our guest as well as direct links to their work so you can dive into the research of this topic a little bit further. The show notes page is also where you can unlock detailed show notes for our show by becoming a patron. On the show notes page, you'll find bonus visual content related to today's episode, including quotes from Shakespeare's plays that feature military sounds, portraits, woodcuts, and museum artifacts related to military sounds and words like alarum and parley, including links to Thomas Heywood and some of the other people that you hear us talk about today. There will be portraits and more information on those. To access all of this detailed content that goes beyond the audio and further into the history, use the Become a Patron button at the bottom of the show notes page. If you're already a patron of our show, that same button will expand today's extras and all the other detailed show notes for our other episodes on the website as well. See all the behind-the-scenes research and in-depth archival information that went into today's show at CassidyCash.com/episode312. That's CassidyCash.com/EP312. Listener support allows That Shakespeare Life to be completely free to listen all over the world. To say thank you for supporting the work we do here, patrons get behind-the-scenes content, access to a private RSS feed, and insider extras, including the chance to contribute directly to programming. You can make a difference in the life of our show when you become a patron today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.